This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This is a special Marketplace podcast from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So back in 2006, we broadcast live from China, a week in Shanghai on the coast, a week in Chongqing, about 900 miles to the west out in Sichuan province. And this year, in June, we went back to do some reporting, to take a look at what's changed for them and for us in a series we call The 5-Year Plan.
The real estate bubble is going to bust.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
Every Wednesday at 3 o'clock, right after school, my kids have to do one of those things that falls under the general category of...
Okay.
You're going to do it because mom and dad said you're going to do it. An hour and a half of Chinese lessons. And yeah, part of that's just us. We speak Chinese. We've lived and worked there. Our daughter is Chinese. Part of it, though, is common sense. We're planning for their economic future. Because by the time they grow up, all right, already, China is driving the global economy. Whether, says China analyst Jim McGregor, it's ready for it or not.
If you look at the world economy as a Broadway musical, and all the countries are up dancing on the stage, and you've got America, Japan, and Europe dancing in the front, China was always dancing in back. And then one day the global financial crisis happened, and China found itself dancing alone. Everybody else collapsed. And so China started thinking, well, maybe I do dance better than everybody else.
There's nothing quite like an international financial crisis to get you thinking about your place in the world.
And as China adds more and more people
See,
to its middle
China's
class,
progress as a threat.
The Chinese customer who's getting paid more these days.
So meanwhile, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world.
From politicians to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, China's on a lot of people's minds right now. It's been 5 years since we took the show there, trying to wrap our heads around the pace of change in that country and what that would mean for our shared economic fates. So this week, the sounds and voices of and about a China 5 years later.
The real estate bubble is going to bust, and it's unavoidable.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
Gentlemen,
don't fall down.
Welcome aboard high-speed CRH train.
The pockets of ordinary Chinese are swollen.
You keep trying to apply Western mentality to a Chinese equation. It doesn't work.
Nobody wants to come and explain it to me.
My dad's a telecom thingy.
Computer engineer.
Yeah. And we train them and we train them and we train them, and now, of course, they're gone. Somebody will always pay them more.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
You are fine. Good.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
New bags, watch, clothes, shoes. Just look at this.
We don't have too many choices. They choose us.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations, that's a hell of an achievement.
Our trip in 2006 to Shanghai on the coast and Chongqing, 900 miles out west in Sichuan province, was all about what happens when a country changes so much, so fast, the goods and the bads. Our trip back, one financial crisis and a global recession later, turns out to have been about the same thing, just with much higher stakes for the rest of us. One of the things we kept saying to ourselves when we were in China last month was, hey, look, the Chinese, they're just like us. You got parents, like me, pushing their kids to learn the language. Because it's the smart thing to do. It turns out that about 7,000 miles and 15 time zones away, at just about the same time my kids were being tormented.
F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F-G-I-F
A couple of Chinese kids were having almost the same experience learning English. Because their dad told them to. Just like us, they want a better life for their kids.
I hope their lives are better than ours. I hope they can make more money, have a better job than me. And I want them to go to university. I hope they can find a better employer, make money easier.
We'll meet Li Yongqin and his family a little bit later this week. But what better place to start our trip back to China than with a look at the future?
They're trying to race past a lot of years and look towards tomorrow because they can't look back.
Jim McGregor's been in China going on 25 years, first as a journalist, now as a businessman and an observer. We talked to Jim when we were here in 2006 about what China's amazing economic performance even then was going to mean for us. So when we decided to come back to see what's changed, we called him again and went out for a walk at a place called Tomorrow Square.
Even though it looks like a clock tower and a school, that was the British Race Club, and the stands were right behind it, and this whole Tomorrow Square area and what's west of it used to be the racetrack and the park.
That's where our hotel was, the Marriott at Tomorrow Square. Nice marketing, right? A futuristic hotel with a wraparound lobby up on the 38th floor. It is aspirational in the extreme. Kind of like the Ferrari dealership right next door. Oh, see, this is good. They've got Maseratis here, too. As I chat up the sales lady, who can't drive, by the way, I learned they sell 15 or so cars a year at $650,000 a piece, mostly to Chinese. Although she does tell me more people buy the Maserati because it's better for families.
No problem.
So as my walk with Jim McGregor continues, I ask him to square that picture of China with the one that most Americans have of this country.
Last time we spoke, you had a line that has stuck with me in the past 5 years. You know, it's an accident of history, you said, that these people are living in a communist society because they are the most daring and ambitious and cutthroat, I think you said, entrepreneurs and business people you will ever see. So you better be ready. You better bring your game.
Remember, these guys have been doing this for a couple thousand years. This is a country that came out of 150 bad years and is coming back. That's their view of the world. You know, they look at us as an accident of history. In one way, it's feeling like it's back, like they have really come through it and now they're on top of the world. On the other hand, they are still very insecure about their place, and they know what they have here is very fragile.
If you look around here, you see unbelievable, the second tallest building in the world, you can see from where we're standing. You see an unbelievably modern subway system that works and is clean. I mean, we've been riding it for 2 weeks, and it's great. I mean, how can they be insecure? How can they be nervous?
Well, because I think they know at the core the contradictions that they are living with. You know, it's run by a communist party that has modern planning. You know, it's kind of like part GE and part the mafia.
Let's stop for a minute in front of the Park Hotel here, this amazing Art Deco building that faces Tomorrow Square. It faces the old racing club. All these folks walking by, those who aren't staring at us doing a radio interview, and as they go about their daily lives, which are, you know, life is life is life, are they thinking about their place in the Chinese economy and China's place in the global economy?
You know, I think people here are just starting to think. They have been on a treadmill. They all came from nothing, and it is a very competitive society, and now they're starting to think about quality of life. They're thinking about work-life balance. They're thinking about their health. You know, psychology has all of a sudden come alive here, and people are going to counselors, and you know, they're now been wealthy for a while, and they're thinking about what is life all about, as much as they are how do I get rich really fast.
Before anybody gets rich, there is business to tend to. 5 years ago, right up the road from where McGregor and I are walking, there used to be a great little dumpling place. I went back to try to find it again. Of course, it was gone. Now it's a hot pot restaurant. Scorpion Sheep Hot Pot, the boss says, famous all over the country. It was a pure business decision, she tells me. Changing menus in a changing market.
Even from 5 years ago, it just seems to me that there are a lot more foreigners here, you know? And that it's not special almost being a foreigner
in China who knows their way around?
You know what? That is a profound change, and I think it's unsettled a lot of the longtime foreign community. And it's also changed the way they treat foreign business. I was at a dinner the other night with six China hands, all been here 25 to 30 years. Some of them were people who could see no wrong in China for many of those years. They really drank the Kool-Aid. And to a person, they're worried sick about this place right now, because that's the big question. How does it last? Because of these contradictions we're talking about.
When we were here 5 years ago, you could see that China was a work in progress. Physically, first of all. In Shanghai, there were construction cranes all over the place. Now, you stand on the riverfront and look out to the new section of the city. It could be Hong Kong, for all the neon and steel and glass towers. But there's a mental aspect, too. People are ready. They're ready for consumerism and middle-class wages and a better life. So, next, what we found when we went looking for that better life. The traditional Chinese, hey, how are you, greeting on the street is kind of interesting. Chifan Lama, it goes. Have you eaten yet? It's about how central food is to Chinese culture, but business as well. And it helps explain why we spent an afternoon last month eating spicy Sichuanese hot pot in Chongqing with a guy named Wang Renqing.
Okay,
so he wishes us the happy Dragon Boat Festival, and we'll have to eat zhongzi, the sticky rice, later.
Hot pot is the specialty in this part of Sichuan province. It's oily and delicious. It uses a tongue-numbing Sichuanese peppercorn that's about as addictive as anything I've ever had. That's actually pretty good. I like it. I asked Mr. Wang, as I chewed on my cow stomach, which is crunchier than you'd think, about China's amazing economy and whether he thinks it can continue.
I'm not going to worry about it. The economy develops smoothly. The customer, Chinese customer, spends money with sense. So I'm not going to worry about it.
Are you afraid of the
prices? Chinese customers are definitely spending. This is one of 400 restaurants Mr. Wang has spread all over the country, each of them bringing in 600,000 yuan. That's about 100,000 US dollars a year.
It could be faster if we don't control it. The market is huge enough to develop a lot more.
Come on, whatever it is, it's all just so good.
His niche in a crowded hot pot market is something called black food. Don't ask me, it's something to do with water and the kidneys. It's supposed to be good for you.
If you eat black food, your hair will get black.
will it at least not go gray? We all buy something. Yeah.
Mr. Wang, who's 48, doesn't look a day over 40. Of course, prosperity helps.
The biggest change Mr. Wang has been seeing is that the pocket of the laobaixing, of ordinary people's pocket, has been swollen, which means they've been making more and more money, and they can afford to go to restaurants.
That's good, man. It means you're doing it right.
So his pockets have been swollen, too.
If it affects China, it will affect the whole industries in China. People have to eat even in wartime, so the food market is huge.
Not everything on the bottom of the pot is edible.
And Mr. Wang never misses a marketing opportunity.
He quoted Chairman Mao saying that if you are eating spicy food, you won't have firm revolution determination.
Chairman Mao aside, Wang is a devout capitalist. He believes in the market and in the unlimited potential of the Chinese consumer. He has, you could say, unbridled optimism. So that's our China theme this Tuesday. Bubble? What bubble? Economic growth in China has averaged 10% a year for the past three decades. And when we were there last month, we did see some signs of a slowdown. But wondering aloud about whether the boom can last forever got us a lot of this.
I don't worry about that too much because I believe it is not a bubble. I believe the urbanization
is empowering all of that. So it has solid fundamentals.
Richard Wong's the international business manager at Taobao. That's kind of a Chinese equivalent of eBay and Amazon all rolled into one. And it's a sentiment we came to call unbridled optimism.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard high-speed CRH train. Please check your ticket.
The trip from Shanghai, inland to the tourist city of Hangzhou, used to take about 3 hours. At 210 miles an hour on the new bullet train, though, takes a little bit over an hour now. And it's a handy metaphor, perhaps, for the pace of change here. Today, honestly, it's just a train that gets us to this guy.
My name is Huang Bin, CEO of Wonder Zara.
Huang Bin's company, Wonder Zara, sells cosmetics online with just a modest ambition.
In the future, all women in the internet who buy the things in the internet will be our customer.
You're sure of that?
I'm sure of that.
That's lofty, right? And it's hard not to get swept up with his enthusiasm because growth has been both fast and furious. Since Wonder Zara launched, and now we don't know what Wonder Zara means either, but since it launched back in 2007, annual sales have grown to 200 million yuan, about $30 million. And Huang says that's going to more than double next year.
Who are your customers now? I mean, who buys cosmetics from you?
Most of them are women.
Yes. What do you think about the place of China in the global economy? I mean, China is now it's the number two economy in the world. It's a growing economic power.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? I mean, do you think about how you're contributing to that?
Maybe a little bit. I want to be the biggest cosmetic company in the world to help people to find the right product and to make them more beautiful and confident.
It's confidence, Huang shows me, that comes in bottles.
This is peach nectar bath soap.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's French, right?
Yeah, French.
Yeah.
And very famous in France. In France.
Yeah, and this is, pardon my French, gel glacé anti-fatigué massage des pieds. So it's anti-fatigue foot gel. It's for your feet.
I don't know.
you don't use this?
I don't use this.
His 300 employees are scattered across three floors in a nondescript, slightly run-down industrial park on the outskirts of Hangzhou. Most of them sit in front of computers chatting online with customers.
Instructions.
Yeah, instructions.
Yeah. So read one for me.
Huh?
给我翻译一下.
你好. 欢迎光临优宇旗舰店，很高兴为您服务.
Hello, welcome to our company. I am very glad to be of service to you.
Yes.
There's a late 1990s Silicon Valley vibe going on here, what with the ping pong tables and 20-somethings in shorts and flip-flops. But this growth is only partly about Mr. Huang and his very impressive, if still relatively small, cosmetics company. It's about the incredible potential of the Chinese economy and of e-commerce specifically. Because a good chunk of this country just doesn't have access to traditional brick-and-mortar retail. Again, Richard Wong, Taobao's head of international business.
In other countries, the number of people who shop online and the number of people who use the internet is basically the same. But it is really different in China. People who have access to the internet are still not shopping. Two-thirds of them are not shopping online.
There are plus or minus 500 million people online in China. The two-thirds of them that don't actively shop online right now, that makes for a potential e-commerce market here of more people than live in the United States. And that's why Huang Bin back at Wonder Zara went for online retail, not traditional.
I'm very impressed by one of my uncles. And he told me, so, wow, you are doing the e-commerce. It's very popular now. The whole office now in my department I go on the internet to buy things.
Of course, for our ambitious but unlikely CEO, there is another upside to this whole online thing.
Why did you choose e-commerce instead of regular retail? I mean, you're a salesman,
that's
right?
That's a very good question. In China, the offline selling is very complicated. They should do a lot of entertainments with the buyer, you see?
You are shy and you don't like to go to parties.
Yes. I like very simple relationship. The e-commerce also do need a very complicated relationship, and then I choose it. I cannot drink at all.
So we skip the drinking, but we do go to lunch after the interview with a stop for a personal sample along the way.
So let me just ask you for myself.
Okay.
Do we have any men's products?
Yep, men products.
This is men product?
This is men products. You can read it.
Helps relieve razor burn, oxygen booster. Oh, you know what's funny, though? This does not smell like me at all. This is not my smell.
It was, all in all, kind of an interesting day, traipsing around a medium-sized Chinese city visiting dot-com companies.
The high-speed CRH train you're taking is...
But on the bullet train back to Shanghai late that afternoon, the ride through the countryside was different. Interesting became challenging. Visibility outside was basically nothing because farmers were burning off their fields, and you could smell it even inside the train. It felt for all the world like a space-age trip backward through the Industrial Revolution. And it reminded us, despite the unbridled optimism, of all the problems that China still has. Next, the downsides of a rising economy. This is a special Marketplace podcast of our series, The 5-Year Plan. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I know they say you can't go back, but that doesn't mean you can't try. So here we go. We came up these stairs around the corner of the Industrial Bank of China and went down the street. While we were in China last month, we retraced our steps from 5 years ago. Flower Market's off to the left. We tried to find the place that we broadcast from in 2006. We'd come down here and walk down this hill. God, this is a gray and dismal and gloomy city. The World Trade Center in Chongqing. It was the tallest building in town by far back then. Helpful, since the time difference between here and the U.S. meant we were going to work at 2 in the morning local time.
Is this Howard Johnson's new?
Chongqing has changed quite a bit since 2006. There is more high-end retail, more of a resemblance to Shanghai.
This is new. And here's a Starbucks, which we could have used. And then down here, right, Deb? There's enough stuff that's new. There's a decent amount of new buildings. The question, though, is anybody in those buildings? Because we would come here at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and if you press the wrong button on the elevator and get off at the 40th floor instead of the 45th or whatever it was that we were going up to, there was nothing. It was bare concrete flooring. It was wires dangling from the ceiling. There was nothing. This was a brand new building in 2006, and it looks like it's been here for 35 years. It's just old and covered in grime, and you have to wonder how anything survives here.
I climb in the elevator, punch the buttons for a couple of random floors.
44th floor. Oh, now here you go. See, this is great. This is exactly it. There is nothing here. I have just come out of the elevator, opens onto a dusty concrete floor. I'll just go give you a sound of the room here. I mean, there's nothing. It is. Here's the dust on the floor. It's crazy. I don't know if you can hear that, but it's there is nothing here.
Not only is there nothing but dust, when I go back to head down, there aren't any elevator call buttons either, just dangling wires. Oh, shit.
Now I'm going down 34 floors on the stairs. Oh, son of a bitch. Oh, man. Wow. Wow, that was a little scary. Okay.
I got out, obviously, but that brief moment of panic didn't make me think. We spent a lot of time in the United States worrying about China and just when they're going to take over the world. Maybe, though, there are other things to worry about. Small things like elevator call buttons, and big things like where China goes from here. Or, as longtime China businessman Kent Kettle puts it,
Deng Xiaoping said, development in China is going to be like crossing the river by feeling for stones. And that's what it is here. There is no bridge.
This is a country with all kinds of challenges to navigate on its way to prosperity. And that is our China story today. How to get there from here. Just walking around China, it's kind of easy to forget about the whole communist thing. The capitalism here is in your face, to say the very least. Which is why it's no small irony that literally around the corner from one of the ritziest and most Western-style shopping centers in Shanghai is the first headquarters of the Chinese Communist Party, with tourists, Chinese tourists, lining up to get in. Our guide, analyst Jim McGregor, explained as we talked on a rainy day.
This is where the Communist Party had its first meeting, but this developer from Hong Kong came in. He realized I'm going to capitalize on this. And he built this exotic shopping center playing on the old Shanghai theme. And look around. This is, I mean, there's foreigners, I think, who live in Shanghai who never make it much more than six blocks away from this place.
If Mao Zedong shows up here today in the middle of Xintiandi, what does he say to himself?
This isn't the kind of party he was thinking of.
The Chinese Communist Party is doing pretty well for itself, even if Chairman Mao wouldn't recognize it. Economic prosperity does go a long way toward political stability. But that prosperity brings with it a problem. How can the government keep meeting rising expectations when a lot of people only know economic growth of 10% a year? Searching for the answer to that question explains how we found ourselves on a Tuesday in Chongqing out in Sichuan province at a job fair.
江苏龙利奇生物科技有限发展有限公司.
3 times a week, the local branch office of the Labor Ministry runs what's best described as a speed dating service for jobs. 23-year-old Zhu Yin is on her 3rd trip to the job market.
有3次了吧,今年的话.
She looked at me kind of funny when I asked her why she kept coming back. And then she said, because this is where the jobs are.
想找一份自己比较满意的工作.
There are posters plastered all over the walls, want ads, basically. Job title, salary, qualifications. Then you head upstairs, and if they like me and I like them, she says,
然后呢,你上去面谈一下,是吧?
对.
We interview. And if they don't like you, I ask. Then I look at other jobs, she says.
这也没有什么.
No big deal. Upstairs, Yuan Yan is having no luck recruiting new hires.
Okay, 今天早上有人来吗?
现目前还没有.
No applicants at all today, she says.
感觉不怎么好找.
Too many companies looking for people. 30 miles outside town, at the Xiangling Auto Parts Factory, we found the exact same thing. The place is an OSHA inspector's nightmare. And while spending 6 days a week in front of a metal grinding wheel isn't our idea of a great job, it's actually a big step up for 23-year-old Duan Yihua. He was working down south in Guangdong in an electronics plant.
电子厂里面,做现场员工之类的。
Came back to Chongqing this spring for a 50% raise. He's making about $500 a month here. The hours are regular, 8 to 5:30. One whole day off every 2 weeks. And plant manager Guo Jingyong says he is still scrambling to find people.
We don't have too many choices. They choose us.
Now, they'll take anybody.
Before, we set some requirement, like they have to be a high school graduate or they have to be under 30. But now we hire people with over 40, over 50. The oldest worker here are over 60.
Most of the workers are serial job hoppers. They're looking for better hours, more money, or both. The government getting people off farms and into factories, making more money, is objectively a good thing. But at the same time, having better lives has made a lot of Chinese a whole lot pickier about how they want to spend their time.
I'll have the manila clams.
100% for us in 5 years. Salary increase.
We met Scott Minoy when we were in China 5 years ago. Back then, his restaurant chain, Element Fresh, was just a single store catering to Westerners looking for something familiar to eat.
The firecracker salmon with 8 spices.
Now, sitting in his 10th location smack in the middle of Shanghai, he shares the exact same frustrations as Mr. Guo, the plant manager, back in Chongqing.
There's a lot of employees that just simply don't want to work in this industry. A lot of the countryside people that are moving into Shanghai, they also have grand dreams of being a CEO one day. And they come in and they're like, what? You mean I have to start out at the bottom?
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, 4 days, okay?
Yeah.
Minoy tries to keep up. He tells people they'll get regular raises, time and a half overtime, all kinds of perks relatively foreign to Chinese places of employment. But it just doesn't seem to matter.
They, you know, people don't think about their future as much. They think about, well, if I go take the job across the street and it pays me 200 maybe more, I can save up for that iPhone just that much quicker. Everybody here has become so much... They're growing more and more materialistic pretty quick. And that's what's driving a lot of the consumption as well.
So here's the ultimate challenge. For a country that built its economic engine on the idea that it's cheaper for companies to set up shop here, what happens when it's not? What happens when wages go up because workers can be choosers? The government has a tricky time ahead, lifting people out of poverty, keeping foreign companies here, and making sure more people prosper. Again, Jim McGregor.
The only way the Communist Party survives
as a leader here is bringing that next billion into the middle class. I don't think people are here are going to settle for a rich elite and a repressed lower class.
It's that economic prosperity brings political stability thing. Coming up, the broad middle ground of the Chinese middle class. The next time somebody tries to tell you that China's not a market economy, tell them this story. See what they say. Every Saturday, in a corner of People's Park in Shanghai, people, mostly mothers, show up with flyers and resumes and a stool, and they set up shop. Trees and benches and walls, even the walkways, are covered with what are basically want ads. It's parents looking for a suitable match for their kids. It's called zhonghun, marriage seating, and not apparently always something that folks there want to talk about. No pictures, she says, pushing my microphone away. Her daughter would be too humiliated, she tells me. The whole thing is amazingly well organized. Parents can search for prospective matches by birth year, by height, by geographic location. And after some looking, I finally find a mom willing to explain the whole thing to me. It's a place, she says, where parents look for love for their children. Her daughter is 27. She's a designer, totally fine with mom doing the matchmaking. Or so mom says. So long as she winds up with a guy born between 1967 and 1983.
Okay, so she wants...
So she's looking for somebody born 76 to 83, so a little bit older. 1.73 meters to 1.8.
So, 稍等一下，比较高的是吧？
Yeah, she wants tall, right? She wants tall. 对. 5'8" or taller, please. And if there is a match mom likes, the guy gets her phone number. And after that, Mrs. Zhao says, nature has to take its course. This all might seem like a lot to go through just to find your child a date. But even though China is clearly a society in transition from deeply traditional to something much more 21st century, there are still plenty of people here, parents specifically, working with a deadline, get married by 30 or be an old maid. It's all about family and the very Chinese interpretation of it, Mrs. Zhao tells me.
女孩子在30岁以前吧，生育是优生优育。 一般女孩子生育最佳年龄是在27、28岁，30岁以内。
Get married, have kids, support grandma and grandpa in their old age. Now, what does all that have to do with the Chinese real estate bubble and the rising expectations of the middle class? Well, that's our China theme for today. We'll put it all together for you a bit later on in the broadcast. So here's a telling story about China, I think. One night while we were in Shanghai, we took a cab out to the suburbs to meet 24-year-old Randy Tian.
Hello, this is my home. Welcome to it.
He said home, you should think apartment, a small one crowded with five people in it. But it's his. And one could reasonably ask why a 24-year-old single guy needs to own his own place in one of the most expensive cities in the world. So we did.
The most popular thing, the important thing is that I can't marry if you have your own apartment. This is China traditional.
If you don't have your own apartment, he said, you can't marry. We double-checked that cultural milepost with financial analyst Jay Wang.
A lot of young people buying the houses not because they like to buy houses, but because they're forced by Chinese culture.
Jay was educated in the U.S., professionally trained on Wall Street, so he knows a little something about bubbles. And now he's back in Shanghai watching it happen all over again in slow motion.
There was real estate bubble in the United States. There's real estate bubble in Europe, right? There was real estate bubble in Japan, in Hong Kong, everywhere, right? China has not experienced a real estate bubble yet. It's unavoidable, right? And I believe it's going to hit China particularly hard.
That may be the case, but you're going to have a tough time convincing Randy Tian. Not only does he own the place he lives in, the marriage apartment, I guess you could call it, he just bought another one. Not worried, though, about a real estate crash.
I think it's impossible, you know. In Shanghai, it's impossible, I think.
Impossible, he said, for there to be a crash.
Have you heard of the housing crash in the United States?
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. Everybody said the same thing about real estate in America. Could never go down. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Here's what happens, though, when there's housing demand fed by an attitude like that. Developers build. They build a lot. You throw in the mass urbanization here, millions of people moving from the country to the cities, and there's almost no way to build enough housing until you build too much. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. It was 2006, Shanghai. New luxurious housing developments were going up all over the place, each trying to outdo the other. One particularly bold developer said, "Top this, a suburb way out on the edge of Shanghai that recreates a quaint village in old England. It's got narrow cobblestone streets, a Gothic cathedral, red telephone booths, and a man-made river, the Thames. This is Thamestown. These days, it might as well be called Ghost Town." The only people I find are two workers replacing some cobblestones. I ask them if there's anyone else here. They direct me to Thamestown's rather unbustling business district. The only place open is a cafe. It's next door to a closed pub and a boarded-up fish and chip shop. Hong Fang owns this place.
My friends warned me that starting a business here would be risky. How can you make money if nobody lives here, they said. They were right. I lost money in the first 2 years. Last year, I came close to breaking even, but it looks like I'm not going to make money again this year.
5 years ago, Hong and her husband bought one of 1,600 homes in Thamestown. Since then, they've watched as speculators bought up property around them and then sat on their investments. They didn't even rent them out. Tsinghua University's Patrick Chovanec says Thamestown is a colorful example of something more serious.
For many years now, we've seen a pattern where people in China pour money into real estate, and often unproductive real estate, as a place to stash their cash.
The problem is investors have driven up property prices to unrealistic levels. Sound familiar? Chovanec says in China's case, it goes beyond being just a real estate bubble. 70% of China's economic growth comes from building things, housing developments, high-speed train lines, things like that. This is all funded through loans from state banks. Banks that, in recent years, have been ordered by China's government to keep on lending.
It's a very seductive idea that all you have to do is simply tell banks, just go forth and lend, and you count the amount that they've lended and the amount that's poured out as GDP, and then there's your growth. And, of course, in the short term, that looks fantastic, but it's not a healthy economy. That's an economy on steroids.
Even China's national auditor says many local governments are now having a problem paying back their loans. An economist with Credit Suisse called the problem China's biggest time bomb. And some believe for places like Thamestown, the bomb has already gone off. On the empty streets, a photographer aims his camera at a couple dressed in a tux and a wedding gown. Thamestown is now one of the most popular spots in Shanghai for wedding photographs. The photographer is Aaron Huang.
I take wedding photos here every day. So does everyone else. It's the perfect place. It's empty and it looks exactly like a European town.
And back at her cafe, Hong Fang may not have any customers, but she says she loves waking up to nothing but the sound of bird singing. It's the peace and quiet of living in a developer's dream of China's limitless potential, a dream some say China may soon wake up from. In Thamestown, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You know how we've been saying the past couple of days how fast things are changing in China? Longtime China watcher Jim McGregor says pretty much the same thing, just better.
A generation lasts 5 years because people 5 years apart are growing up in a different China.
Our story today is in two acts, two economic generations by McGregor's reckoning, starting with 36-year-old contractor Li Yongqian. On a hot, sweaty late Friday afternoon in Chongqing, we ride the 113 city bus home with Mr. Li. He's been checking progress at one of the half-dozen apartment renovations he's got going on. It's about an hour on the bus tonight, faster than usual, he says. A 20-minute walk, and then 11 floors up in a tiny little elevator to his apartment. It's small, but by Chinese standards, heck, by Manhattan standards, there's plenty of room for the four of them. Yeah, four of them. They've got two boys, paid the fines under the one-child policy. And one of the kids, at least, is eager to practice his English.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm fine.
You are fine. Good.
As Mr. Lee cooks dinner, his wife and I talk about how their lives have changed the past 5 years.
Life is better than before. Every day is a holiday.
Did you get that? Every day is a holiday. The Lee family is the very picture of upwardly mobile China. He brings home 8,000 yuan, about $1,200 a month. They've got a flat-screen TV, a fridge, a water cooler, two air conditioners, with a third on the list of things to buy next.
We make more money, but we spend more at the same time.
We couldn't afford anything before, but we just got the refrigerator, the TV sets, and we bought the apartment in 2007.
But it's not just the big-ticket items they're spending their money on. Inflation hit a three-year high last month when we were there, 6.5%. So the price of daily life, that's bus fare, food, all of it, is rising fast. Still, the Lees have a lot of hope about the future.
I hope my sons' lives are better than ours. I hope they can make more money, have a better job than me. I want them to go to university. I hope they can find a better employer, make money easier.
The Lees have a lot more money than just a couple of years ago, but they're still saving more than half of what he brings home. China analyst Paul French explains.
People who have been doing extremely well, who've got themselves a nice little apartment, who've got themselves a nice car, suddenly wake up tomorrow and their mum's had a stroke. Within a matter of weeks, the bank accounts of their single child are emptied. There is no net. The ability to just fall and keep on falling down until you touch an absolutely horrible rock bottom is the massive major difference between China as it is at the moment and most of the societies that we come from in the West.
It wasn't quite rock bottom, but not long after Mr. Lee's wife, Cheng Jia Sheng, started up her bakery business a couple of months ago, an industrial mixer took a chunk out of her arm. $5,000 for medical expenses. No insurance. Another $12,000 down the drain from losing the business because the flour she'd bought was tainted. The risks of the relentless Chinese economy are real, but so too, says Paul French, are the possibilities.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations, well, that's a hell of an achievement. China is not going to look to its past, right? It's not a kind of country where like a lot of our countries, where we can turn around and say, you know, things were better in the past. Things were not better under Mao.
Act two of our trip through the Chinese middle class starts with 28-year-old Dora Chai.
So I would say that I would just make the best of the job and try to learn as much as I can and see where that takes me.
Dora fits the McGregor construct perfectly. She's 5 years younger than the Lees out in Chongqing. Economically, though, she's living in a different country. She's got a college degree, a great job in PR at the Chinese internet giant Alibaba that she loves, and lots of online shopping with her two credit cards.
I'm a shopaholic, and I spent a lot of money on Taobao. I'm pretty guilty about it as well.
She's got a new apartment, a cute new Peugeot 307 hatchback, and a keen awareness of what economic independence means for her future.
As young people, we are confident. We are new in this world. We want to see where our potentials are. Happiness is about, it's not about you get all the things you want. It is about you get the things that you want after you worked really hard for it.
Dora Chai and her economic generation make the place that we started today, the marriage market in Shanghai and being married by 30, seem very far away, old-fashioned even.
You are 28?
Yes.
You don't have much time left.
Why?
I don't know.
I have a lifetime left. Why? Like, when is my deadline?
I don't know.
Then why is there so much time left? Property is sort of the leverage to get you, you know, higher up in the marriage marketplace. But also, I believe in myself. I think I have the ability to make money to stand on my own feet. So it's necessary, but I don't see the rush.
She might not see the rush, but the rest of the Chinese economy sure does. Not about marriage, but about business and quality of life and those rising expectations we've been talking about all week. And therein lies another challenge for the Chinese government, says China Hand Jim McGregor.
So the government runs scared of these of their people's expectations because their only legitimacy is performance. It's not like they have an electoral legitimacy. And that's where China, when China talks about its own kind of democracy,
they're not talking nonsense. That's what they really believe. They believe that they are, their form of democracy is they have to perform in order to please their citizens.
Next, we wrap up the five-year plan with American companies doing their best to please the citizens of the biggest market on earth. On our last day in Shanghai, before we came home, we had kind of an L.A. moment. Reminded me a lot of a game people play around the office sometimes. The one where, if they made a movie of this place, who would play you? So we were sitting in my hotel room doing an interview with expat American businessman Jim Rice. He first came to China 20 years ago, right after college.
I stayed mostly at the time. It was because I thought the women were beautiful and the beer was cheap. And so it turned into a career. Not the women or the beer, but the working in China.
Suffice it to say, he's a character, hail fellow, well-met, knows everybody, heads up the Shanghai chapter of the local Harley-Davidson Club, and now is an unofficial consultant on a Hollywood movie. It's about an American lawyer who comes to China on assignment, fumbles his way through the finer points of cultural interaction, and winds up looking for help from some old China hands.
One of the American business people he turns to is based on me, and this character is governor of the American Chamber of Commerce, like I am, and president of a chicken company, and rides a Harley. So.
And who plays you in the movie?
Bill Paxton.
Oh, look, it's Bill Paxton.
Hello.
And there it was, our Hollywood moment.
Just happened to be walking by your suite, and I heard my name, and, you know, I'm an actor, so of course I showed up.
Hanging out with Bill Paxton in the Shanghai Marriott on Tomorrow Square. All right, so maybe we took a little bit of poetic license there, but there is a point, because if Hollywood's finally figured out there's a movie to be made about American companies coming to China, there must be something to it. You know what? There is. American companies that came to China, found their fortunes, or lost their shirts. That's later in the show. All right, so here's something that wasn't in China when we were here 5 years ago. Harley Davidson. Our first Saturday in Shanghai, we went out to the local Harley dealer to take a ride with the Hogs, the Harley owners group, both Chinese and Americans.
Hi, I'm Jim Rice.
Our guide is Jim Rice. You met him earlier. He's one of those people Malcolm Gladwell would call a connector. Knows everybody, schmoozes everybody, makes introductions. The Chinese call it guanxi. Essentially, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
I think we're going to get rained out.
Yeah, this is actual rain, too.
Sadly, we've come to China at the start of rainy season, and Shanghai traffic is lethal enough without riding a motorcycle on wet, slippery streets. So we don't go. Instead, it's coffee and donuts upstairs in what I guess you'd call a clubhouse. Hey. Couches, coffee tables, Harley memorabilia everywhere. An average Harley Davidson back home costs maybe $15,000, $16,000. Here, thanks to import duties, $35,000 or $40,000.
It's very luxurious. It's very, very expensive.
Jimmy Jung is one of today's rained-out riders.
People are out here now trying to show off their wealth. When you ride a bike, I think head-turning around Shanghai with a Harley is maybe more than a Ferrari now.
He's also going to open a Harley dealership himself out in Suzhou, about 50 miles west of Shanghai, because he wants a piece of this growth industry. Just 6 months in, sales this year have already beaten all of 2010. It's an American brand that speaks to a changing Chinese sensibility. Sean Zhang is the managing director for Harley-Davidson China.
Even in such a traditional society as China, there are population. They are in a position financially, mentally, and socially to be able to use an American icon product to distinguish themselves and to show that they're successful.
Their customers are successful, so Harley's successful. Zhang plans to add 3 or maybe 4 new dealerships every year for the next 4 years. Harley knows it needs to be in China in part because of another American icon.
Everybody knows about GM's success here. They have done such a beautiful job in identifying a local partner, and their relationship with the local partner is very, very strong. And that's in the industry, it's a known story.
The story of GM is one of the highlights of corporate America in China. It's been hugely profitable here, even as it was being bailed out at home.
When I came here 6 years ago, we did just over 550,000 units. Last year, we did 2.35 million units.
Sales up 400%, so you could say it's been a good run for Kevin Whale. He took over GM China in 2005.
How do you square then the bailout that General Motors got from the federal government with the profitability that you guys have here? Make that make sense to the American taxpayer.
General Motors has been around for a long time. People were aware that we developed a whole series of legacy costs associated with various things. If you contrast that to China, we started with a clean slate. We moved into the market at the right time.
You can say that again.
We moved into the market at the right time.
That would be the time of an exploding Chinese middle class, complete with middle class aspirations, like wanting to own a car. Timing, it turns out, really is everything.
So this is the cashier. That's the GMAC desk, though, so financing's growing.
Richard Choi meets us at a dealership selling GM's latest China brand, Chevy.
This is our beginning to be our accessories area.
It's only been on the market here since 2005, but last year they sold a million cars, including quite a few, here at the biggest dealership in Shanghai. Richard Choi runs Chevy's China sales and marketing. He knows exactly what he's going after. Wannabe buyers, 25 to 35, probably with a family or soon to start one.
So we're trying to capture that in terms of how we are positioning Chevrolet. Our slogan, actually, is the future is coming for me. Wei lai wei wo er lai. The whole idea about this is to say Chevrolet as a brand, we understand that you're on your way and we want to be the car that takes you there.
Before those customers can get on their way, they have to come see Ms. Wu. She's the sales manager, so I ask her to give me the sales pitch. It's a little bit like in the States and a little bit different.
Game on, they get sales talk.
We say hi, she says, as soon as they walk in. We give them our name card. And we ask them whether it's the first time they've been here. There's not a whole lot of negotiation, she says. The price is the price is the price. There's a sporty-looking red coupe over in the corner, but I try to be the sensible consumer and look for something that'll fit my family.
Okay, what's that make? Well, you're still a child.
I've got four kids, I tell her. Six people to schlep around. Not a commonly heard problem here in the land of the one-child policy. But Miss Wu doesn't miss a beat. Buy two cars, she says, and like all good salespeople, creates opportunity out of disadvantage. Kind of like GM in China. But when we told our Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, over dinner one night about our tale of American companies doing it right here, he offered us a slightly different take. And so we met up at Hong Kong Plaza in Shanghai, one of the two biggest shopping districts in the city. We were outside a very empty Gap store, a company that most definitely got it wrong with a high-profile branding campaign here, their 1969 jeans.
The Gap decided that one of its major lines of clothing, the 1969 jeans brand, it would be its cornerstone of its marketing here in China. 1969 might have been an interesting year in the U.S. It was not an interesting year in China. In fact, it was towards the end of the Cultural Revolution. It's a time in China when people were burning down monasteries, they were defacing Buddhist statues, they were torturing intellectuals. Not really a year that you want to remember.
That's cultural misfire number one. The 1969 campaign is what Gap's had in stores in the United States, of course, so that is misfire number two, not localizing your brand. But for all the successes and mistakes that American companies have made so far, now, says longtime businessman Kent Kettle, is the time to figure it out and get it right.
Last year sometime, I was having a conversation with a bunch of other guys that I know who've been here 15, 20 years. And one of the guys said, okay, would you rather have been here 20 years ago till now or now in 20 years from now?
Oh, good question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who said, no, now, because now is when it's real. Now, GM relies on China to be hitting on all cylinders or else something bad happens. That is cool. We were just playing. We were garage band before. We were just a garage band. And you know what? If you go out and make a few bucks, cool. It's fun. But it's real now. In a way that it never has been.
It's easy to forget how little time has passed since China wasn't much more than a global economic afterthought. It was 40 years ago today that President Nixon announced he was going to go to Beijing and meet with Chairman Mao. Since then, Since then, just look at what's happened. It's enough to make the world's biggest economy a little uneasy. Uncertain, really, about the unknown. That's why we went to China 5 years ago, and it's why we went back. As often happens when you travel, any place, cab drivers can deliver perspective along with a ride to wherever you're going. Wang Juqi has been driving a taxi in Chongqing for 15 years.
中国,
China growing like it has is a good thing, he says. It'll make things better for other countries. And yeah, that's basically the party line here. But it's also not entirely wrong. Because as we said when we started this week, the global economy is going to need some help. And it ain't the developed world that's driving things these days. One last bit of China cabbie wisdom before we wind things up. We were, I don't even remember where we were, in a cab one day. And our Chinese producer asked the driver when we'd be there. And he said in Chinese, "Ma shang zhou da le," pretty common phrase, but pretty vague, too. It can mean, like, 5 minutes, or it's going to be a little while. And it occurs to me that that's what we've been trying to get to all week. When's China going to be ready to help out? Could be soon. Could be a while. Our China series, The 5-Year Plan, was produced by Deborah Clark. Fiona Ng didn't get to go along with us, but she did most of the heavy lifting back here. All the great sound you heard? Jeff Peters, our audio engineer, did that. Our web stuff was produced by Amir Nouri. I'm Kai Rezdahl, and that was The 5-Year Plan. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.